Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
K-Nut.
Hey, Howard.
What's going on? We got another European on today.
I know, we do.
Yeah, he hates Norway. Confided that to me.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
So we can bring it up with him if we let him. But loves rabbits. No one likes rabbits more than Ross Mason. Little known fact. Just found that out as he chases them down in Switzerland. And he's probably got Sound of Music on in the background too, because that's what you do if you live in Switzerland. Hey, so Knut, today we're going to get right into it. I have Ross Mason. He founded MuleSoft early. I think he was 12 when he figured out the API economy was going to be big, and ran away from home and just started building software. What's the name of the country that he went for? Anyways, we'll get into it. I've only got to hang with Ross a few times. We share a board with one of his buddies that I'm an investor in, that we're both investors in LA. After selling MuleSoft and helping transition and be at Salesforce for a while, he has a new venture firm called Dig Ventures.
Nice.
So I want to talk about the future of technology too. Why? I mean, you talk to a guy who built a $6 billion company over 15 years, you got to ask him what's going to happen in the future. So, and as you saw, small world. Chetan was a board member at MuleSoft.
Look at that.
So it's just so weird that they were back to back. Okay. So let's get Ross over in Europe on the phone.
You got it.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Who is this?
This is captain of the bunny rabbit squad. How are you, Ross? It's Howard.
Oh, I'm glad you find that so amusing. Yeah. So in my spare time.
My kids are out of the house. Anybody suffering with kids at home, and by suffering, it's all in context, obviously. You're not suffering. But anybody with kids at home is good for me. Anybody who's had a harder time at home during COVID than I have, it's good. And you're locked away in the Alps, no, in Switzerland?
I am. Yeah, it's not such a bad place to be locked away, actually.
So how long have you been holed up?
Since it started, I've been here since July last year. So I was here when the pandemic happened, and then I isolated for about 10 weeks, and then I got sick of it like everyone else, and I started doing social distancing, and it's been pretty good. Like, I like running, I like biking, so being in the Swiss Alps is actually amazing.
Spectacular there. Well, yeah, biking. We still haven't done our bike ride together, but we will. It's my first summer not in Europe in forever. But as soon as I lift quarantine, I will be there. Do you miss the U.S. at all or no?
You know what? If it wasn't such a shit show, I think I probably would. But just every time you dial into what's happening in the U.S., it's just one pretty major catastrophe after another. And a lot of my friends are still there because I lived there for 10 years and they're all pinging me saying, what's it like in Switzerland? I need to get out of this place. So I think the effects of this year are going to probably last for a couple of years at least.
Yeah, I feel like Google they said a year. So at least next summer. And so you just got to mentally prepare for that. Now, I wanted to dig right into a couple subjects. We'll go back and talk about MuleSoft. Then we will talk about the future and Dig Ventures and what you love doing now. Because you're young. How old are you?
I'm 23. I'm not really. I'm 45.
Oh, you're 45. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the secret is I post on Instagram. I use a range of skincare products.
So I just started. I wish I had kind of taken that more seriously because I have good skin. But, you know, the sun does catch up with you. And you were born in England?
Yeah, exactly.
And when did you get the entrepreneur bug for MuleSoft? Because it was a long time ago.
I think I actually had the entrepreneur bug from birth. I remember, by the way, we'll probably get into this at some point, but I'm a huge Lego fan, much bigger fan of Lego than I am of rabbits. I like rabbits, but Lego I love. And I started a Lego club in my school. My mum had a photocopier and I got her to photocopy Lego badges, and I started charging kids $50 for membership. And I eventually got in trouble and had to give some of the money back. But I was making big promises about the club and, you know, what it would be. And ultimately, it was just me at the age of seven selling photocopies of Lego logos. And that was my first entrepreneurial endeavor, I think.
Well, I would say of all toys, Lego was kind of like a hardware open source product.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like, if you think about it, and I actually wonder about this, like, how much did that influence the way I thought about software and APIs?
And who introduced you to Lego? Just it was just something every kid had, I guess, back in the day. I didn't know it was so big in London or in England.
No, I don't think it was. And actually, it was tough for my family because we didn't have any money and it's quite expensive. But apparently, somebody got me some Duplo when I was 18 months old. And then I bashed the bricks together. And as my mum tells the story, I just never wanted anything else ever again. I just love the feel and the construction and creativity of Lego.
Yeah, me too. Did it pass through to the kids or no?
Not as much. I also think I might have smothered them with bricks and that hasn't helped. Plus it's two daughters and I actually think Lego needs to do an even better job of appealing more broadly. They do some lines, but a lot of the sets seem to gear a little bit more to boys for some reason.
And is there a game, an Apple iPhone, or is it Roblox, or is it a Minecraft? Is there a modern version of Lego for the software-minded?
Well, it was Minecraft, I think. Mm-hmm. And you know, Lego should have bought that way before Microsoft had a look at it. But I just don't think they saw that opportunity at the time.
Oh, can you imagine a product manager coming with that idea? It would have been shot in the face.
If you look at what Lego have done, right, it's pretty incredible. They only make one toy, like one interchangeable brick, and they make billions of them. And they're the biggest toy company on Earth. And it's because they've done a really good job of fusing the digital channels and the playability of these bricks. But it still, it dumbfounds me that it can be better than every other toy combined, from Hasbro or, something Mattel or anyone else. But it's incredible. They just have managed to take the brick to literally the farthest corners you could imagine.
Which is probably why software is just the biggest industry in the world. If Lego was the best game, open source game, the fact that you can do it endlessly in software kind of just proves the point. So when did you get involved in computers? What do you remember?
Yeah, I do. So I saved up all my pocket money. And then about when I was 13 or 14, maybe 13, I bought a PC, a 1640, which was like a 186 or x86 processor. And it was an absolute piece of junk. It was from Amstrad, which I don't know if you know Amstrad, but they're like a British PC brand. And they're a horrible plastic. Uh-huh. They didn't work very well. But I love this thing. And I just poured all my energy into it. And that's where I got started.
And was it, you just understood it from the beginning? Because I remember getting my first Apple and I'm like, I just couldn't, I was into hockey and sports and it stood at this. And my dad was nice enough to have given that to me, like a piano. I had everything around me and I just didn't understand it. Did you understand it right from the beginning, even though it didn't have much functionality?
I think so. Part of it was, I was always sort of, I always thought they were interesting. Like, if you remember the old articles, you used to get these articles where you could just code stuff. And that just blew my mind that you could create something within this thing and you could play a racing game or a maze game or something. So the programming side was really interesting, but I didn't get the programming side at all. But what I did get was the sort of hardware, how it fitted together. Memory kind of optimization back in the day when you only had 640K base memory and just running software. And so for me, the first year was just discovering it and trying to write basic programming. And then I discovered the world of software. And I think I can say it now because we're all older and wiser, but I actually started a software piracy ring where I would buy and sell discs. And if you pay more for the discs, you'd get software on it. And then I would distribute a catalog through the discs that I was selling through trade magazines. And that just caught my interest. It was just like this idea that you had this thing that you could create a business with. And of course, now I realize I was stealing people's software. But at the time, it was just really incredible endeavor. It was really fun.
And so what gave you the idea for MuleSoft? And explain the name too.
Yeah, so MuleSoft, I was working in banking in Switzerland, and as really as a software developer IT guy, and it was insane how complicated it was to connect things. And then when I moved to London, I had this idea that I wanted to start a software company, but I had no idea how. And back then, there wasn't all these blogs telling you how to start companies and how to think about problems. And so my solution was I go and work for a software company versus I was working for a bank, which is a bit different, and I'll go and figure out how they build software that other people use. And I worked for a small middleware vendor in London. And during that time, I worked on one pretty high profile project in London, and it sort of really sparked the idea of enterprise architecture for me, and also how kind of broken enterprise software was at the time. And so, yeah, I built an open source project. Back then, open source was mostly Apache at the time. And there was a lot of movement with Apache in London, in particular, where I was based. And so I thought, I'll solve this problem the way I think it should be solved, and I'll open source it. And, when back then, all open source projects basically were named after an animal. And I named mine Mule because it was a carrier of a payload and was reliable worker. That was the name behind it.
Fascinating. Okay, so that's a great geeky insight. So they were named after animals. What animals still around? That's interesting.
Well, Tomcat was a big one back then, right? So it was the basis of every application server. I guess I'm trying to think which other animals. But you had languages like Python. You had.
New company will be called Rabbit Technologies, I hope.
It is actually Rabbit Technologies. Actually, a good friend of mine actually wrote Rabbit MQ, and I think their company is called Rabbit Technologies. I'd probably go with Giraffe, and I don't know why. I just think it's like a hilarious logo that you could play with.
Awesome. So when you start the company, you started, what, 2006, 2007?
Yeah, 2007.
Did you raise money, or did you bootstrap it? What was the idea?
So I actually raised money. I was bootstrapping with a consultancy that I started called Symphony Soft. And actually, interestingly, that company just got bought and has been announced this week. So it's kind of crazy that I'm even talking about this. But I had a software consultancy around the open source project. One day I did a business model and realized I wasn't ever going to get any leverage out of a consultancy on the software. And I was lucky enough to know a few people in San Francisco who introduced me to some VCs, and that got the ball rolling. And then I just started pitching pretty aggressively in early 2007.
And so did you have a partner at the time, or is it just you?
I did. So I met this guy. He was part of the Linux magazine. He was like one of the editors, I guess. And he was doing an MBA, and he was on this thing called a Kauffman Fellowship. And basically, that was like a fast track to becoming a VC from an MBA. And he got to the final of this fellowship. And he and I had actually spoken about MuleSoft, and we talked about doing the open source TIBCO. And TIBCO, for the uninitiated, was one of the big integration players of the day. And he called me out of the blue just as I literally just finished this business plan and thought, fuck, I need to do something else. And he called me the very next day and he said, I'm in this Kauffman Fellowship. There's 20 other people here. Nobody's interested in what I'm pitching. They all want ideas in China, because China was kind of booming in terms of tech VC back in 2005 and beyond. And he said, what do you think if I start pitching open source TIBCO? And we literally spent the afternoon on Skype building a deck, and he ran with that. And that was the first meetings we had. And then I went out of the US and we refined it greatly and went back out on the road. It was kind of surreal the way it happened. It all happened within, a couple of months. It was crazy.
And it's not with open source, there's no overnight success, right? So those early years are really lean years.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I bootstrapped it for 2 years. And the reason I could raise money back then was because I had JP Morgan, who I'd pretty much camped out with. for 9 months to tell investors if Mule had a company behind it, we'd buy a subscription from them. And I think that's really what got my investors over the line. You know, back then there was no seed investing, so you didn't, you couldn't bet on founders and early products or even, you know, market opportunity and idea. You had to have something to get to an A round. And so what I had was a vibrant open source project. And I had a couple of customers who would be references for me saying they would buy a subscription to MuleSoft support, or sorry, Mule support if a company existed behind the project.
And so who was the first big customer?
Well, the first person actually who said they'd be a customer was JP Morgan. And I've been working in their investment bank group, working with them. I wasn't part of the bank, but I came in like once a week to work with them. But actually they ended up not buying in the first few months. And I think the first buyer was, and it's terrible because I've actually forgotten the name. It was a name of a company in New Zealand, bizarrely, that had built some stuff on this software and they were right about going to production. And I think they were the first people to actually buy software from us, which of course threw in all sorts of complications because they were in the, you know, they're in New Zealand, different currencies. You know, from day one, the problem with open source is you're global and you have to decide whether to take the money in, you know, every region or just in certain regions. And in the beginning, we just took it from everywhere.
And when did it come to you that you had something? When did you really think you had something?
You know, it's weird. I think you always think you have something, because otherwise, if you don't, then you start questioning whether you should be doing it in the first place. So okay. I think what happened there was just these big moments, pivotal moments where I remember thinking, oh, wow, this has just upgraded what I think this is, versus me, you know, thinking, oh, this is nothing to something. You know, I guess back then, validation that you could raise $4 million, that was a kind of a shock to me. I'd never dealt with those kind of numbers before. And to, you know, now we sort of, we're a bit blasé and, you know, founders create companies and they create products and they raise money and it's always in the millions. But back then, it wasn't so accessible. There wasn't the network. There wasn't the seed funds. So the first validation was actually getting a term sheet and realizing, wow, this is actually, you know, this is $4 million. I've never seen so many zeros. And then the next thing is, oh crap, what the hell what am I going to do with this? You know, you think you're ready to figure it out.
Was it NEA that offered the 4 million?
No, they came in later, but it was Hummer Winblad and Morgan Fowler, who are now Canvas Ventures, came in as the partner, the secondary partner.
It's so funny. You're talking about seed, and it's like those are such old school names that have probably changed their names, you're saying, Canvas, right? Like, it's so interesting how the industry is just, because I started seed investing in 06 after I'd sold my company, and it was still like, I was just writing checks like a lunatic, but no one knew what seed investing was. It just seemed obvious to me.
We didn't even really know it existed. I remember all the time we were looking at a priced round, an A round investment without really a business model. So they had to get comfortable with the open source traction and the fact we had a couple of customers that would buy but haven't actually bought anything yet and no commercial product. So, I mean, I think we spoke to probably between 60 and 70 investors for the first round. A lot of people just said no right straight away and a few people understood what we're trying to do, but it was a lot of work pitching to get over the line. It wasn't a slam dunk.
Well, there were no social networks. These kids today, right? Like, it's like if they don't have a term sheet the first hour from a tweet, they have a meltdown.
These kids today.
Yeah. So I had Chetan on my show. So small world from, he's now at Benchmark, but in NEA. How'd you get connected with NEA? When did they come along?
So first of all, I love Chetan. He's got this view of the world that can be a bit polarizing within the company in terms of we had invited him to an all hands. And he got in front of the whole company and said, there's no reason why you're not 10x bigger and you don't have any competition and you have, you know, green fill running, which is absolutely right. From an investor standpoint, that's exactly what we saw. But you never tell that to your salespeople because they're like every day they are competing with every other vendor. And same with customer success, same with services. But, you know, he's amazing just pushing you to think bigger all the time. And that's what we really liked about him. And the way we got connected was... they actually contacted us. So he'd done a bunch of background research on us. You know, he's very research focused and metrics focused, as you know. And he came to us and he pitched our company. to us. And it was the craziest thing, because I remember looking at Greg and Greg saying to me, who's our CEO at the time, that's probably the best pitch I've ever seen of our company. And, you know, we're responsible for doing that. And so, you know, he opened the door and then just got us thinking bigger. And you know, it was just exciting to have someone at NEA and someone like Chaitin, you know, join the company and fund the company. And that was probably, I guess that was our E round. So we'd actually done a bunch of financing by then, you know, working our way through the alphabet. However, he really saw what we saw, but we hadn't found investors that really had seen what we thought the company could be yet.
And how much total was raised, do you, if you remember? A couple hundred million or under a couple hundred?
This is still pretty lean. It was just over a quarter of a billion. Yeah, it was like 258 million. Goldman Sachs gave us trophies, which is a sort of weird thing. It just sits on your desk reminding you of how much money you raised. It's sort of a weird trophy, but anyway.
And hopefully that trophy is now, you've given it to an enemy or somebody that you dislike, or do you still have it?
I just make copies of it and just send it out randomly to people just to stay relevant.
Yeah. And were they helpful, or did they just want your wealth management business?
Oh, I probably shouldn't talk about them. I have a bit of a... Yeah, I wanted them to be customers, and they kind of slow rolled it and never really delivered, and it was kind of annoying because, you know, I think you should be in it if you're going to get the business.
You've said all we need to know about Goldman. Would have guessed that. So, how many employees were there at MuleSoft?
1,600.
The company wasn't implied. I remember owning the stock. I didn't know you. I randomly wrote a blog post about it, open source. You know, I'm not a geek. I'm late to all this. This was probably 2 years ago. And your friend, Mr. Grimes, emailed me, goes, "Well, I can introduce you to Ross." I'm like, I don't want to bug him. It's just a blog post. It's just my thesis. And like 2 weeks later, you guys got acquired by Salesforce. So it got me more interested because I was like, whoa, that came out of the blue. Was Salesforce some company that was in your head, a possible buyer at some point in time, or did it come out of the blue?
It was. There was only two buyers, I think, for MuleSoft. It was either going to be Microsoft or Salesforce. And, you know, I think it definitely made more sense for Salesforce. And we weren't looking to be bought. In actual fact, the timing was kind of rough because we just finished our, you know, all hands. If you know this, but MuleSoft, even at that scale, we would take the whole company offline for a week, fly everyone in to San Diego, and we'd do a week-long session with the whole organization, really just ironing out the kinks, doing a lot of cross-functional, you know, breaking down of rocks, and then a lot of sort of vision and culture alignment. And it was pretty pivot, you know, it's pretty important to our company that everyone was aligned because it's not an easy sell. Like, you're selling middleware that essentially lives with organizations for at least 10 years. So, you know, you've got to really deliver on everything that we promise. And then 2 weeks later, Salesforce comes in out of the blue. So it wasn't like it was a planned thing, just said, hey, you know, we want to make a serious offer. So it was out of the blue. But if you'd ever asked me who would ever come in, Salesforce are probably at the top of the list.
And did he come in directly, Benioff, or one of the corp dev guys? I know a lot of the people there.
Well, Samuljai, we've actually had, so he's the SVP, you know, but I've had loads of interactions with him because we did an investment early on. We actually pitched them on a deeper partnership about 5 years ago. So there's a pretty good timeline between MuleSoft and Salesforce. And, you know, interestingly, their success in some ways drove our ability to see what was coming next, because what we saw, even in the open source project, was more and more people were connecting to cloud systems versus on-premise systems. And when I was looking at the data for the connectors, who was using what, Salesforce was way up on top. And then it was pretty easy to see, well, okay, if Salesforce is there, pretty much every other piece of software will go this direction. So we need to have, if apps go into the cloud, then we need integration in the cloud. And actually, MuleSoft was the first one to release, or really helped define integration platform as a service, which is basically integration in the cloud as well.
Wow. And API economy, you've talked a lot about it on stage. To my audience and to the they hear this word thrown around, and I don't think people are scared to always ask a question. What does it really mean? And what got you so excited about it and continues today?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I mean, let's break it down to the two words, right? So economy is really, you know, supply and demand and exchange of value, right? And in its broader sense, a digital economy is just the digital trade of goods between suppliers and consumers. Well, APIs are the vehicles to deliver those goods. That's how, you know, Facebook can log you in wherever you want. It's the same way that we can run algorithms across data sets to figure out if there's anomalies or if there's, you know, security leaks, whatever else. And then, so the API is very basic. All it is a software construct that defines an interaction between a consumer and a provider. Right. And it is abstract, and it's a bit like having a waiter at a restaurant, right? When you want to order food, the menu is really the contract. And then you execute on that contract by giving the waiter the order. He goes to the kitchen, he fulfills the order, he brings it back. And you know from the menu that you ordered a lasagna. When the lasagna arrives, you got what you expected. If you didn't get what you expect, you get an error. Right, so that's the most basic way of describing what an API does in a digital economy. But it's pretty foundational because as everything goes digital, everything interacts through some type of API. There's just no other way of doing it. So, you know, it's been pretty fundamental. And what we've seen from companies that bet on this model, they've just had outsized gains. You know, I talk about Salesforce again, just because they understood the importance of the API very early on. And you know, even 7 years ago, even though they were known as a CRM company, they were making more money by directly offering APIs to the database without having the CRM front end. And they realized that very early, and they started charging a different price point for that. And you know, it's one of the reasons why their model is so strong is because they just really understood the value of their data and providing access to it through APIs, not just the interface.
And so is the API economy still early? I mean, obviously, I, as a fund, invest in it still. So is it early or am I late?
No, it's super early. It's very nascent. It's a bit like, you know, when do you ever read The Everything Store?
Yes.
About Bezos and Amazon. I think a lot of people read that, right? So I remember reading that and Bezos talking about internet, you know, e-commerce and internet commerce being super nascent. And this was 3-4 years ago. And this is really a time where most of us were getting, you know, 3 Amazon parcels a week. Well, you can see now very quickly that we're nowhere near where e-commerce could be. And he was absolutely right. And we're in the same place with APIs. The difference is we haven't actually figured out with APIs how to unlock most of the value of the digital assets that companies have. So, for example, we don't know really how to unlock data in a trustworthy way so I can share it with other people without losing the data. So the next wave of APIs will be figuring out data marketplaces and how to exchange information without losing the value inherently within that data. And so I'd say, and that's just like level one stuff. Like, we haven't gone to sort of level two, which starts getting a lot more algorithmic in the way in which you source or find or compile data, and functionality. So in my mind, it's still very early days and it's still very experimental. Like, companies are still really trying to figure out what it means. But it's like it'll end up being the nervous system for most organizations for all the digital capabilities.
And is Dig Ventures going to do that? What's the purpose of Dig Venture? I know it's to fit into this ecosystem where you can help founders get going much quicker. But what kind of stuff are you looking for at Dig Venture?
Our thesis is really narrow and pretty worth noting. We get called a VC a lot. And of course, the world definitely needs more VCs, tongue in cheek. But actually, we're a family office. But we're structured like a VC. And the reason I did it is because I wanted to see if we could change the role and expectation of a VC while not having LPs, which might be one of the limiting factors of being a VC in the first place. But for me, Dig Ventures was a bit like an experiment because I love investing. I love talking to founders. And, you know, selfishly, the reason I do it is because I love hearing about how other people are solving the next wave of problems. I love getting insights from people on the type of problems they're seeing and pressure testing their ideas on, is it really a trend or is it a fad or is it something that's pretty fundamental to the way we're operating? So all those sort of conversations are really exciting for me. And the best way to have those is to invest, right? You meet people that you gel with that you like, they have ideas that you like. And frankly, if I dig the idea and it's within our thesis, we invest. And that's kind of where Dig Ventures came from, is we just don't invest in stuff that looks good on paper, but we're not that excited about. My test is always, would I talk about this at a dinner party? If the answer is no, then I probably won't invest in it.
Right. And size checks, will you do 250 above, or is it like a certain size?
So the model I'm proving out is meaningful ownership with meaningful value. So we look for 5% ownership. So we don't lead, but we definitely aren't a small check at the end. We started following on you know, some of the big venture firms in the UK. What's starting to happen is people are coming to us first now, and then we can bring in a partner that would actually lead the round as well. So that's kind of exciting for us. And the idea is, in the first 2 years, founders should be asking a lot of questions and looking for a lot of input on things like culture setup, hiring, not just hiring people, but hiring culture and how to think about the culture of the organization, go to market and sales, right? And these are all areas that I love. I've got a couple of people who work with me, one in particular, she's almost like a startup business consultant. And we do a bunch of workshops. We do a lot of sort of coaching around even smaller things that end up having a big impact, like setting up a sales process. How do you do it? And we, rather than just saying, well, this is five good resources, we actually sit down with the team and understand their business and help them lay out a sales process. We do the same for hiring. We do the same for go to market. But we even do things like helping enterprise software companies create compelling events, right? Giving someone a reason to actually buy today versus tomorrow, which I think is a bit of an art in enterprise software selling. Something we did very well at MuleSoft that we've started to productize through our workshops to help founders get more successful.
Yeah, that's genius. So you're loving it. Do you like it more than operating?
Good question. I'm going to be really honest with you. I think ultimately I love operating. I love to build. So watching people build at some point just gives you the itch that you have to go and build something yourself. I'm also a realist, and I think this is the best choice for me in life right now. And I get a lot of joy out of working with the founders that we work with. So it's a high class choice for me. I enjoy both, but if I look deep down, I think at some point I'm probably going to start another company again.
I feel like it because this is what I say about operators, because I'm definitely not. And I love investing. Like, you could never draw me back in. Obviously, there's enough tools for guys like me to just be a company of one for the size of, I don't know anything about culture and just didn't get the right mentorship at the right time. And now I'm old. So I feel like there's not enough great operators for all the great creators. So I think it's going to be hard for operators to stay on the sideline because there's just always going to be good opportunity for operators.
That's right. And there's so much good stuff out there, and there's so many smart people, so many good ideas. And, you know, it's crazy. Once you have an exit, you don't even need to have the idea yourself. I think that's what I love about this space. I love about software in general is it's still so nascent, yet it's still so, you know, we've got some learnings. We've figured out some stuff, but there's so much further to go. And that for me is exciting because it just means in my lifetime, I'm never going to be bored. I'm never going to sit back and think, geez, I've got nothing to do today. There's always something fun happening.
Yeah, there's just always something. How do you deal with Europe versus US? Obviously, you live in Europe. You love Europe. Your family's there. Friends are there. But you have friends in the US. It is far. In a post-COVID world, it is far. In a world of possible quarantines and headaches, it is far. And at the same time, you know, you have crazy politics all over the world, just as bad in Europe, obviously worse in some countries. And you have a rising euro on top of all this, a rising euro. Who would have thought that? Like an exploding euro again. So in that backdrop, how do you level set what to focus on?
On the friends front, I still have some network here. A lot of my friends are in the US. Some of them I invest in, and then I host their board meetings in Geneva.
Nice perk.
That works. But seriously, I'm really establishing roots again in Europe. It's funny, COVID has forced me to make a, you know, mindset decision. You know, I moved here, but I think I was still doing a lot in the US, and I've just decided, look, I can't get there anytime soon. And, you know, it's not a burning platform if I don't go. So I've just decided to focus all my energy here. You know, my family's here, which is the reason I came back in the first place. I wanted to spend more time with my parents, my sister, and my brother, etc. And I've been doing that. It's been fantastic. And then I started a fund here so that I could bring sort of some more operational knowledge collectively to the founder communities in the UK. And we're doing a lot in Germany for some reason. It just seems to be those two hubs seem to be most active in enterprise software. And yeah, you know, I'm still, it's working. It's interesting. So, you know, I still do 99% of my investment in Europe right now, but every now and again, I invest in a company in the US. So most recently, I invested in Syncari, which is a really interesting data platform that kind of takes the data view that where MuleSoft was taking the application view. And so that one's pretty interesting to me. And so if I find a good company like that, then I'll get involved. But I'm doing it a lot less in the US.
And then public market, I mean, I have so much to cover, so we'll probably have to do this again. But in public markets, you know, where there's so little to choose from, even though it seems like NASDAQ goes up every day, there really is, obviously, because of the way these stocks are going up, it's proof that supply is not big enough for the demand of capital. And yes. I was talking to Chaitin, and basically I said, oh, well, let's start an ETF together in open source. But there really are three companies. So in a world where Elastic, Mongo, and I guess Salesforce isn't a straight, even though they bought MuleSoft, it's not a straight open source company. So is there, how do you have to just, like, I'm long Elastic, not long Mongo for some stupid reason. How do you express yourself in the public markets knowing what you know in the private markets, or do you not care?
So I did the same thing as you. I went long on Elastic and not Mongo. And I think just because I saw the Amazon decimation of Mongo in the early days, well, with DataStax, actually. But I always put those two together, and so I didn't go with them. But I, you know, I've been assessing this. I have a tech portfolio that I run myself. Of course, I work with a financial advisor on a bunch of other things. But I run a tech portfolio myself, and it's by far, obviously, because where things are, the highest performing. I'm trying to get my head around the multiples in the public markets today. And, you know, what's interesting, if you think about the flow of money, and this is kind of fascinating to me, you've got the Federal Reserve pumping money into the economy. Because nobody can go out and they can't spend money, they can't do social things, they've actually started jumping on Robinhood, which if you look at the visualization of the market, most of the new money coming into the market is retail. So it's individual investors investing some money. And you think about why people are doing that. It's not because they just have excess. It's because they have nowhere else to put the money. You know, with low inflation and zero interest rates means there's no point having it in a bank. And then Bitcoin is, you know, does reasonably well, but everyone's been a bit burned by that. So everyone goes to equities. And then with equities, what brands do people know that are doing well? Well, it's all the tech brands, right? It's pretty easy to draw a line between Microsoft and COVID and Zoom and COVID and even Salesforce and COVID. So what's happening is you're getting a lot, which nerves me a bit, you get a lot of retail investment in these companies. And then, you know, recently I was just reading an article in the Financial Times that SoftBank has started putting options on companies, which is probably the exact wrong thing for, I mean, it makes sense for them, I guess, but not for their investors, because that's not what they bought into. And you realize the problem is there's just not enough places to put money right now. So equities will be the place. And then I was thinking, well, do I buy back in or do I hold back? And then I've kind of come to the conclusion that actually I should buy in. And I'm fairly pragmatic, so I thought that would be the other way. But the reason to buy in is because the Fed is going to keep pumping money in for the next 18 months because they cannot afford to have a collapsed economy. And it's so bad now that if they stopped, it would be pretty awful. So they're going to keep doing it. That money is going to be surplus. It's going to go into these tech companies. Crazily, people like, you know, Bezos and others are going to become multi-billionaires every week, which seems like the wrong way to distribute wealth. But I think that's kind of where the US is right now. I think one, you know, Bezos or someone should actually step in who's making a shitload of money right now, who doesn't need it, and just say, look, we'll start paying for certain government programs like vaccination rollouts or something like that, just to pay it back into the economy. Because, you know, like, I can't imagine one of those guys needing, and you know, the extra $40 billion they made this year on the markets. And why not just do, like, why not just feed it right back into the system again? It's a very interesting, massive imbalance of the economy, and obviously the ultra rich and the regular Joe. And I don't know where it's going to go next. It's kind of interesting.
When did you get into the markets? What makes me excited as an angel investor in Robinhood, and I have to share some other deals within Europe because there's 1,000 Robinhoods being born, and you and I haven't caught up in a while, so I owe you a side Lego bar. We're at this point where you just summed it up. I do this show called Momentum Mondays every Monday, and I'm like, at the top is, if you look at global monetary supply, that rules the day right now. You know, you like it or not like it. And there's just not enough good supply of companies that people want to own across the world, which is cloud-based, you know, where everybody was TAM-trapped and everybody was like, you know, spreadsheets don't matter in the cloud. Their columns aren't big enough. There is no such thing as an analyst when they can't figure out what the TAM is. So you have that going on, and Goldman and SPACs, and the world will come up with this. You'll start another company to take advantage of this because you'll just have to, you know, the right thing will come along and the operators will get back in the game and brush off. And just when you least expect it, supply will trump. The only thing that kills us right now is supply, because there's just not a fundamental reason, as the market's been politicized for the last 20 years, for it to be unpoliticized, right? It's everybody's interest to just keep the farce going. So I'm with you there. I obviously, because I have human emotions and because I have a brain that tries to process math, I've been underinvested, but I've made up for it in my private investing. Has watching the public markets been interesting for you, or a waste of time, or fun?
Yeah, no, it's been absolutely fascinating. I'm fascinated by it because all the rules of economics, by the way, I'm a hobby economist. So I don't know, I haven't got a good background. I haven't got the academic background in it, but I'm just fascinated because, you know, what we've basically seen, and I've been trying to figure out what would happen next. And I think there's only one scenario. What we've seen is quantitative easing, basically the government printing cash to keep the economy afloat when things get tough. And we saw it in 2008, and everyone thought the inflation would go crazy, and it didn't. And the reason it didn't is because there was enough cash put in that the economy could recover and create more demand. And the curve just smoothed out. And then you think, well, okay, well, why doesn't everyone do this? And what's happened in COVID is everyone has done it. Everyone's just printed money across the globe. And is that a country level? So the countries that are going to suffer are the ones where you lose faith in the economy first, right? Because, you know, back in Napoleon's time, you had a revolution and, you know, the commoners took power back very aggressively and violently. And there's no such way of doing that. But if you look at the common person who works at Walmart or at McDonald's or is driving Uber for 12 hours a day, this world makes no sense to them, right? They're reading every day that Bezos just made a $40 billion more in his net worth in the last 9 months when the world is crumbling around them. And it's not hard to see that at some point, like, you got to hate that. You got to hate capitalism. You got to hate that the fact that this is what happens to the money when it feeds into the market. So there has to be a revolution. And the only revolution I can see happening, because it won't happen through violence, the faith in the American economy would have to get to a point where other countries and other nations decided it was no longer worth investing there. But I got to tell you, the way things are right now, there's no way I wouldn't invest in the US.
You know, what's exciting about this world is it's a language, right? I look at money as a language. You know, the crypto people have been selling that, their language of decentralization, which is really software. They have a long way to go and a lot of bad marketing to overcome. And like you said, the hiccup is a lot of people have still been burnt. You know, their 1999 was only a couple of years ago. So like you said, the only alternative, which makes it hard as an investor that tries to care about prices and valuations to see how close we are to 1999, but with real businesses and real cash flow, but the NASDAQ is 30% extended from its 200-day moving average. So it's like feels unpractical for smart people to just buy recklessly. But hey, if you own apartment buildings and you have the marginal utility of one more apartment building to your portfolio, if you own 100 buildings versus putting that, you know, 1% into digital NASDAQ 100 stocks, I mean, no time like the present.
I'm about to say, yeah, don't load up, but definitely, spread your bets a bit. Because, I mean, that's the thing is like there's nowhere else for the money to go. So you could look at the earnings multiples and say that's ridiculous because it's two times where it was a year ago. But it's sort of where it was from an acquisition standpoint. That's what MuleSoft actually got acquired for, is, you know, 21 trailing, you know, forward-looking revenues. But the thing is, if there's nowhere else for the money to go and those companies are successful, so companies like Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Amazon, I mean, they're all very successful. They're all going to make, they're all going to hit their revenue targets. They don't need to blow out of the water, but suddenly they become more valuable because they're the safest bet in the market. And that's a weird dynamic that we haven't seen before is, you know, high margin software businesses are just seen as fundamentally much safer right now than almost anything else, thanks to COVID. That's what you're seeing. You're seeing one element, one tiny virus that spawned out of Wuhan. It's kind of crazy. This is like the butterfly wings flapping kind of thing. This one tiny virus happened somewhere in China, and now the world has changed. And it's incredible how quickly it happened. We lived through it, and you can try and make sense of it or say it's not realistic. And I've been in the not realistic camp for a very long time. But the more I think about it, I just think this is the new normal. And I wouldn't go too hard. I wouldn't go all in. But I would definitely spread your bets on the tech companies. And it would not just the big ones, but I would actually, like you say, the Mongos, the Elastics. I love Elastic, by the way. You know, all those guys are worth looking at and taking a long, hard look again, even though the valuations look crazy right now. Okta, I love. All good. Atlassian.
Team, amazing company. Well, hopefully, because we're locked down, I can have you back on. Was it painful or did you enjoy this?
You know, apart from I had to go and run out when we're doing the sound check to go and put my rabbits away because they had escaped. This has been a very pleasant conversation.
Yeah, I love that you love the markets. That's where I really like to go. Listen, people need to understand the pain and the story of MuleSoft and how early you are lugging the open source rock up a hill. So, you know, you're an early pioneer there. I think people still, I just had Chathan and you, people like me still struggle with what open source really means because it seems like such a bad business decision by an entrepreneur to go open source, you know? Like, it just seems like, well, that's stupid.
It is. And you know, if you want to make money, why give away your key asset? It's a bit like being a pop star. You know, you actually give everything away before you even got the contract. it's kind of broken that way. But there is, you know, as you can see, there's ways to optimize it afterwards, which you can't do with a record contract.
Yeah, fantastic. And so I'll ping you again. Like, I mean, listen, we follow the markets. We'll end up investing in some companies together, which I'm excited about. And the borders will open. I was early to just say, hey, I'm changing. I'm going to be the best COVID person I can be. And, you know, I only get to see you in LA at board meetings. But I tapped into this early and trying to convince my kids. I said, the kids, you got to get a mindset on. This is a year and a half. Like, country's not suited politically to handle this. And it was social media and the polarization of people. So, you know, hunker down. And I think I got lucky as an investor in Robinhood and eToro. I was just as scared in StockTwits. You know, we know what volatility does. If March and April spread into May and the market stayed down, that volatility would have turned into apathy. And that can lead to very ugly things. You know, like what follows volatility sometimes is that apathy, and then traffic goes to zero and people stop looking at their brokerage accounts. So we got the opposite. So whether we were lucky or not, by April, I was like, you got to see these numbers. This is staggering. And so I knew early that there was a big shift going on. And I think this language of the markets and private markets connected to the public markets and reading the tea leaves in many different ways that the old institutions don't have this data. They haven't figured out how to read the market in a world that's broken out of Excel. We're not in an Excel world anymore. And businesses that are confined to Excel, like hotels and financial leverage. Ugh.
Well, my parents are hoteliers. They actually have two hotels, and it's been a rough time for them.
Owning two hotels, I say, versus owning 100 digital companies would be harder to own two hotels.
Absolutely. But they love it. That's the thing. The difference is it's a job of passion. And the problem is, if you own 100 stocks, it's not passion; it's something else. It's a bit more introverted.
it's a game, whereas owning the business and showing up every day is not a game. It's the challenge. Yeah. It's the life. Well, take care of the family. I'm glad you're okay. And I really appreciate you dropping knowledge on the StockTwits community here. And congrats, obviously, with MuleSoft and Salesforce. Do you still own Salesforce? I imagine you do.
Of course. I mean, I wouldn't want to miss out on the 30% bump last week.
It's really just fascinating. Really just fascinating. And do you keep in touch with Chetan at all at Benchmark?
You know, actually, we have. We on investments. I love Chetan. Great. He's a great guy. He's, you know, I love Benchmark. Actually, you know, if I'm honest, I was a bit of a fanboy of Fenton back in the day. He never invested in us. I was always disappointed because he had some really good views on open source businesses. But yeah, no, I mean, we've touched base every 6 to 9 months, I think.
Yeah, Index and Benchmark are very big in open source. So I imagine, Dig, yep. I think you'll make a play there eventually too. So I'm excited to be connected. And hopefully I will see you soon for a bike ride. And in the meantime, be well.
Absolutely. This was great. I haven't actually spoken about public markets to anyone much. So this was a good fun today. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Next time we'll do 100% of that. And we'll awesome. Dig a little deeper. All right. Cheers.
All right. Cheers, Howard. Bye-bye.
K-Nut.
Hey.
Lovely chap.
What is it about the British accent? It makes him sound so sophisticated.
Yeah. He's just going to hop in his Maserati and pull out cool weapons out of his pocket and report to Moneypenny about his open source
exactly.
trading idea. It's just goddamn. And then you put like I got a Southwest VC on the phone and it's like, I wouldn't buy anything from them. Whereas an English person could just be selling you anything, and you're going, I'm in.
That's so true.
Other than that Nigel idiot. All right, so Britain's got their own problems, no matter how smart they sound.
No doubt.
Equal distribution of stupidity. What's great about smart people and podcasts, where the smart people are connecting and talking and sharing. So I love that, Ross. That's our thing in common, because I don't understand half the stuff he's talking about with open source, but the public markets are where. And it's exciting to see people, you know, who don't need to participate, but are definitely participating and thinking through these really complicated problems, meaning I don't need to participate. Maybe I shouldn't participate because of the prices and the valuations, but like pragmatically, it makes no sense not to. So this is what makes markets great. All right, I'm going to let everybody go. You can, if you like the podcast, Panic with Friends, go to Spotify, Apple, Google, search Panic with Friends, search my name, Howard Lindzen, StockTwits, my producer, Knut, been hanging with Knut since we were in our 20s. 30 years now. He's the producer, StockTwits distributing and made it all possible. And you like what I have to say, you go to my free blog, howardlindzen.com. I have a daily email on trends, markets, private, public, etc. Have a great day. Knut, thanks.
Thank you.